another 400 between now and October. Although McNamara contrived to enjoy virtually unchallenged credibility as a brilliant analyst, it was unclear on what facts and interpretations he had based his estimate. Without a clear idea of the objective, the military strategy under which U.S. forces would operate remained unclear as well. When the president asked McNamara, "What are we doing with the 95,000 troops?" he responded, "Not too much," and offered general need as justification. In opposition to Westmoreland's concept for expanding offensive operations, Taylor emphasized the strike reserve proposal that he had advocated in March. He linked the air campaign to the troop increase with the vague observation that they were complementary. McNamara faced the challenge of explaining to the JCS the decision to grant only a portion of Westmoreland's request. After he returned to his Pentagon office, the Defense Secretary telephoned the president. McNamara recognized the incompatibility between the president's desire to take the middle approach and pursue a stalemate in the near term, and the Joint Chiefs' belief that, once committed, the United States should apply the level of force necessary to defeat Vietnamese communist forces. McNamara told the president that, "In the back of my mind, I have a very definite limitation on commitment in mind, and I don't think the chiefs do. In fact, I know they don't." LBJ asked, "Do you think that the Westmoreland request is just the next step with them up the ladder?" "Yes," McNamara responded. "They hope they don't have to go any further, but Westmoreland outlines in his cable the step beyond it, and he doesn't say that's the last." McNamara, however, neither communicated to the chiefs the limitation on commitment, nor asked them what might be achieved with the additional troops or what strategy was appropriate to that level of force. Wheeler first became aware of the president's decision to commit only those troops necessary to hold on through the summer at a June 11th National Security Council meeting. The meeting, designed to build consensus behind the president's decision, included Wheeler, McNamara, McNaughton, Rusk, Ball, Rayburn, Katzenbach, UN Ambassador Adlai Stevenson, Reedy, the Bundy brothers, and several other officials. Beginning the meeting with an explanation of the legal justification for his policy under the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, Johnson limited the scope of the discussion to ways of holding the situation. Taylor, who had agreed to McNamara's force ceiling of 100,000 troops, minimized the difficulty of the situation in South Vietnam. He told the audience that the present VC campaign will be terminated without serious losses. After preliminary remarks that put Westmoreland's request in the context of a difficult but far from desperate situation in Vietnam, McNamara misrepresented its scale. He ignored the second portion, a total of 34 battalions and 175,000 troops, stating instead that Westmoreland recommends that the 13 battalions authorized be increased to 23 battalions, 123,000 men. McNamara highlighted divisions among the chiefs to suggest that they did not fully support Westmoreland's request or his advocacy of an aggressive war against the Viet Cong. He claimed that the chiefs opposed the deployment of U.S. forces in the central highlands of South Vietnam and wanted the new forces to be used as a mobile reserve near the coast. Wheeler quietly challenged both Taylor's depiction of the situation and McNamara's portrayal of the JCS position. He stated that chiefs are impressed by General Westmoreland's presentation of the need for more U.S. forces. The Defense Department's proposal calls for deploying fewer troops now than either General Westmoreland or the Joint Chiefs recommend. The chiefs favor taking a decision now on sending the number of troops recommended by General Westmoreland. The McNamara plan would send fewer forces now and keep our options open to send additional forces later. Wheeler's effort was futile. The decision had already been made. The president closed the meeting with the following statement. "We must delay and deter the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong as much as we can and as simply as we can, without going all out. When we grant General Westmoreland's request, it means that we get in deeper, and it is harder to get out. They think they are winning, and we think they are. We must determine which course gives us the maximum protection at the least cost." The president had used the logic of graduated pressure to rationalize his continued pursuit of a policy that would allow him to maintain a consensus. William Bundy recalled that Johnson had decided to try to keep the middle ground. Just what this meant in terms of U.S. forces was not spelled out or decided. As the president spoke of keeping his options open, two Viet Cong regiments were overrunning the U.S. Special Forces camp at Dong Xoai and inflicting another disastrous defeat on the South Vietnamese Army. The middle ground that the president had occupied for so long was crumbling beneath him. Despite his recognition that his advisors had no plan for victory militarily or diplomatically, Lyndon Johnson remained resolved to do only what was necessary to avoid defeat in Vietnam. Fixated on short-term expedience and lacking a comprehensive estimate of what the war might cost the United States in the long term, the president focused on the more easily discernible price of withdrawal. "Pulling out," Johnson confided to his most trusted advisors, made him shudder to think what all of them would say. As Johnson approved additional troop deployments to prevent defeat in the South, he continued to defer a decision on the fundamental nature of his policy. LBJ told Ball that he wanted to keep his options open until after the monsoon season, when he planned to get an appreciation for congressional sentiments in connection with Vietnam. After September, Johnson hoped to forge a united front in Congress behind his policy. Ball suggested that Johnson keep new troop deployments to a minimum so he could keep the power of decision and keep control. With each troop deployment, however, Johnson was sinking the United States deeper into what his old friend Clifford had described as a quagmire. On June 18th, the president formally approved a portion of Westmoreland's request. The Air Mobile 1st Cavalry Division, 9 battalions, 23,000 troops, would be sent to South Vietnam. Depending on the situation, two brigades already approved for deployment might withdraw sometime in the future. Consistent with McNamara's recommendation of 1 week earlier, if those brigades were to remain, 23 battalions, 123,000 troops, would be committed to South Vietnam. The JCS had found the 23-battalion force level acceptable because McNamara promised to consider leaving in South Vietnam the battalions marked for possible withdrawal. Westmoreland, however, protested. He thought unrealistic McNamara's suggestion that 123,000 U.S. troops represented an upper threshold of our ground commitment, and that thereafter a cut of 3 to 6 battalions might be enforced. Westmoreland reminded Sharp and Wheeler of his belief that extraordinary measures were necessary just to stabilize the situation, and that more combat strength would probably be required to carry the war to the enemy. Westmoreland disagreed with McNamara's argument that the piecemeal approval of his request had provided the MACV commander with maximum flexibility. McNamara kept the military on the president's team, while hiding from them his determination to keep the U.S. commitment sharply limited. To help the president steer a middle course, McNamara began to develop a program aimed at achieving a stalemate in Vietnam. By definition, McNamara's objective did not entail compelling the enemy to accept terms favorable to U.S. interests. American involvement in the war continued to escalate in a vacuum of strategic thought and without a clear plan of action aimed at achieving decisive results. McNamara recalled that at the end of June 1965, Lyndon Johnson felt tortured and was deeply torn over what to do about Vietnam. The president had finally begun to recognize the consequences of the decisions he had made during the previous 5 months. He had discovered that once Americans were committed to direct combat in the air against the North and on the ground in the South, he had no option but to continue to deepen American intervention and assume even greater responsibility for the war effort. The rationale of graduated pressure, that incremental intensifications of the war were reversible and therefore could be pursued at low cost, had committed the United States to war before Johnson had given himself and the country an opportunity to decide whether that commitment would be in the interest of the United States. Blinded by his desire to pass the Great Society legislative program, the president had found Vietnam a nuisance that he hoped would go away. Sensing LBJ's desire for an easy answer to what seemed an intractable problem, his most trusted civilian advisors gave Johnson what he wanted. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, moreover, let the assumptions on which the president's policy was based go unchallenged and chose instead to work within his constraints in an effort to intensify the war effort by degrees. By the end of June, however, the path of least resistance had left Lyndon Johnson at a dead end. He had used rhetoric equating opposition to his policy with the abandonment of American soldiers on the front lines. If he rejected military requests for additional forces, those same charges could be leveled against him. In the next weeks, LBJ's series of small decisions on ground troops would push the number of troops approved for deployment to South Vietnam over 120,000. Decisions made from the beginning of Op Plan 34A operations in January 1964 through the first airstrikes against North Vietnam in response to the real or imagined Gulf of Tonkin incidents, to the incremental decisions of February through June 1965, had already committed the United States to war. By July 1965, it was no longer a question of whether the United States would deepen its involvement in Vietnam, but how the president would reconcile the demands of war with those of the Great Society. Chapter 15, Five Silent Men, July 1965. What the military officer isn't taught is how to cope with the accommodation required in the political process. There must be clearer and more rigid standards for the man in uniform whose responsibility ends in human life, in contrast to standards for the man in civilian clothes who does not face the specter of death in his mind as he deliberates on actions that might be taken. General Harold K. Johnson, 1973. As George Ball made one last futile attempt to prevent what had already become an American war in Vietnam, the president continued to rely on McNamara to maintain consensus behind his pursuit of the middle ground. On June 23rd, Ball recommended that the United States cut its losses in Vietnam. When McNamara and Rusk opposed this proposal and argued for deepening American military involvement, the president directed that McNamara and Ball put their views in writing. Before the memos were complete, however, McNamara persuaded Ball to abandon his radical proposal for withdrawal in favor of a proposal that the United States minimize its liabilities by limiting troop deployments to 72,000 and restricting their combat role. Bombing would continue, but the area around Hanoi and Haiphong would remain off limits. McNamara, arguing that Ball's paper was unacceptable because it did not offer a good way out, received assistance from Rusk, who predicted that pulling out of Vietnam would damage U.S. credibility, which is the pillar of peace throughout the world. Rusk argued that such a diminution of American reputation would lead to our ruin and almost certainly to catastrophic war. With Ball's dangerous paper suppressed, McNamara continued to build consensus behind the proposal that he was developing in the Pentagon. McNamara told McNaughton to outline a political and military scenario for American intervention in Vietnam, following the president's instructions to include the smallest group possible in the planning effort in order to minimize the possibility of leaks. The defense secretary asked the joint staff to develop a list of specific military actions that could be taken in Vietnam, but did not permit the JCS themselves to participate in higher-level discussions concerning policy or strategic options. Indeed, McNamara, with Wheeler's assistance, kept the other chiefs in the dark about the latest planning effort. Although McNamara ostensibly included Wheeler in this process, he excluded the general from substantive deliberations by lying to him about the subject of meetings with Ball, Rusk, McGeorge Bundy, McNaughton, and others. With the joint staff providing only technical advice and the JCS shut out of policy meetings, the list of military actions were consistent with the president's call to kill more Viet Cong. And so the discussions emphasized tactics and means rather than strategy and the end state desired in Vietnam. Overlooking the complexities of countering the political and military challenges of defeating an insurgency, military operations were aimed at killing large numbers of the enemy in conventional battles and at hounding, harassing, and hurting the Viet Cong should they elect not to stand and fight. The report requested more troop deployments and emphasized the tactic of launching 800 B-52 strikes against Viet Cong havens and following up each air raid with a prompt entry of ground forces into the struck area. The latest planning effort continued to equate any activity with progress rather than providing a vision for ending the war on terms favorable to the United States. These expanded military and political moves, McNamara wrote to LBJ, would convince North Vietnam and the Viet Cong that the odds are against their winning. By default, attrition had become the military strategy, and stalemate was its objective. Even as he excluded the JCS from policy discussions, McNamara remained committed to keeping the chiefs on the team. He retained in his paper the full list of military actions developed by the joint staff, even though it included military measures that went far beyond the limitations he envisioned. In the first draft of his paper on the expansion of U.S. military pressure, McNamara recommended the deployment of 40 battalions to raise the number of U.S. troops to 200,000. Consistent with JCS plans for mobilization, the paper suggested a reserve call-up of 100,000 and the extension of tours of duty for those already in the service. The paper also proposed expanding the air campaign against North Vietnam, including bombing port facilities, mining harbors, destroying transportation and industrial targets closer to Hanoi, and intensifying aerial interdiction. Aircraft would attack North Vietnamese airfields and surface-to-air missile sites as necessary. But McNamara never genuinely considered advocating the measures that the Joint Staff had recommended. McGeorge Bundy, who thought that the principal purpose of ground troops would be to preserve American credibility by covering an eventual retreat, criticized the military actions contained in McNamara's paper as rash to the point of folly. McNamara responded that he would be more than willing to abandon controversial military recommendations, noting, however, that the Joint Chiefs of Staff are strongly in favor of going even further. McNamara appeased the JCS by keeping his memo unchanged, while, by privately professing a willingness to drop military recommendations, he preserved the support of McGeorge Bundy and Rusk, who favored limited military actions. Although William Bundy described the last week in June as the time for pleadings, the president's advisors settled their differences out of court. Before the president met with his advisors on July 1st, McGeorge Bundy sent him a memorandum to which he attached the Vietnam policy papers from McNamara and Ball and from Rusk and William Bundy. Rusk's paper highlighted the damage to U.S. credibility that would attend a withdrawal from Vietnam, and William Bundy proposed that the administration limit additional troop deployments while waiting to see what happens. McGeorge Bundy advised Johnson to listen hard to George Ball and then reject his proposal. Bundy suggested that Johnson then choose between McNamara's and William Bundy's options and told the president that McNamara was willing to tone down the recommendations in his paper. 2 days before McGeorge Bundy forwarded the advisor's memos to the president, however, LBJ had rendered Ball's and William Bundy's recommendations irrelevant to the current situation by approving the immediate deployment to Vietnam of 3 additional Marine units comprising 11,000 men in response to an urgent request from Westmoreland. With the pattern of slowly deepening American military involvement in Vietnam well established, the president attempted to build support within his administration, in Congress, and among the public. On July 2nd, as more U.S. Marines landed at Da Nang and Quy Nhon, Johnson met with his closest advisors. To protect the consensus they had reached around McNamara's toned-down recommendation for further military action, McNamara and Rusk wanted the meeting kept small because, according to McGeorge Bundy, they felt strongly that the George Ball paper should not be argued with you in any audience larger than yourself, Rusk, McNamara, Ball, and me. They feel that it is exceedingly dangerous to have this possibility reported in a wide circle. Moreover, both of them feel great reticence about expressing their innermost thoughts to you in front of any larger group. Johnson, however, was already following the consensus that McNamara had worked to contrive. To build further support for his decision to gradually introduce more troops into South Vietnam while maintaining the sharp limitations on the use of force against the North, McNamara would travel to Saigon in mid-July for further consideration of Westmoreland's request. The JCS, with whom McNamara had last met on June 28th, had no influence over the administration's response to Westmoreland's request. Even as the Joint Staff worked with McNaughton, Wheeler kept the service chiefs ignorant of the McNamara memo until it was completed. Wheeler was determined to give Westmoreland his unqualified support and present McNamara with a unified view from the chiefs, and Green, who preferred the enclave strategy to Westmoreland's concept of offensive action aimed at destroying concentrations of Vietnamese communist forces, might have complicated Wheeler's effort. When Green discovered on June 28th that he and his colleagues had been kept uninformed about the McNamara memo for nearly a week, he concluded the Joint Chiefs of Staff influence had reached a new low. Despite Green's disappointment, however, service parochialism continued to undermine the chief's ability to cooperate on urgent matters of national security. Admiral Sharp, who was in Washington for a brief visit, warned Green that General Westmoreland and Ambassador Taylor do not like Marines and will do everything they can to prevent the Marine Corps from getting credit for their accomplishments in South Vietnam. Green's conversation with Sharp turned him toward improving press coverage of Marine Corps actions rather than evaluating the decision to deploy more troops. Believing that the war would require up to 3 times as many troops as the president was currently considering, the JCS, meanwhile, continued to advocate incremental troop deployments. Harold Johnson estimated that to guarantee a free and independent South Vietnam would take 600,000 to 700,000 troops and 5 years of fighting. Wallace Green's figure also went as high as 700,000. General Johnson recalled that, despite their personal estimates, the JCS never made a recommendation for the total force. In addition, the chief's disagreements on how to use U.S. military force went unheard and unresolved. As the president enlarged the American commitment in Vietnam, he had yet to hear from his military advisors concerning how the U.S. military would fight the war, or how many troops it might take to force a settlement consistent with the stated policy goal of maintaining the freedom and independence of South Vietnam. In a July 10th meeting with the JCS, McNamara told the chiefs that the president had decided to move forward in South Vietnam, but had not yet decided on a specific course of action. He warned the JCS to keep what he was about to tell them out of the news. He divulged that the president had, on July 8th, approved the deployment to South Vietnam of the full 34 battalions that Westmoreland had requested. The total force of more than 200,000 would be in South Vietnam by November 1st. After making the announcement, McNamara reviewed the details of the impending mobilization and deployment. The Marine Corps would mobilize a 4th Marine Division, an air wing, and add 3 new brigades of 3 battalions each to the force structure. The reserve and newly formed units would be combat ready within 4 to 6 months. The Army would call up 27 reserve battalions and, to replace eventually the reserve units, would organize another 27 regular Army battalions from scratch. If the need existed, the reserves might remain on active duty. McNamara told the chiefs that the first priority would be to get troops into South Vietnam as fast as they can be absorbed. All that remained, he said, was the formal announcement of the decision. The Congress and the American public, however, would have to be softened up. Public relations, McNamara told the chiefs, was the principal reason for his impending trip to South Vietnam. Green found McNamara's announcement astonishing. He thought that the requirement for additional forces and the deployment of both regulars and reserves had not been carefully thought through. Green recorded at the time that McNamara conducted the JCS meeting in a condescending and impatient manner. He left Green with the impression that the chiefs had become technicians whose principal responsibility was to carry out decisions already made, rather than fully participating in the planning and advisory process. While preparing deployment plans and a concept for how to use U.S. forces, McNamara and Wheeler bypassed the other members of the JCS. Green would not discover until July 12th that, since July 2nd, an ad hoc committee under Goodpaster's direction had been charged by Wheeler with determining what assurance the U.S. can have of winning if we do everything we can. As Goodpaster's committee scrambled to develop a military strategy for Vietnam, civilian officials in the Department of Defense made the effort frivolous. Although McNamara had told the president that he had a very definite limitation on commitment in mind, he did not tell Goodpaster or the JCS that such a constraint existed, lest the chiefs balk at explicit limitations. After he arrived in Saigon, McNamara asked Westmoreland whether, based on the assumption that enemy efforts did not increase, 34 U.S. battalions would suffice to prove to the Viet Cong and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam that they cannot win in South Vietnam. Although he had assumed away the possibility of an enemy response to an American buildup and limited the military objective to stalemate, McNamara did not get the answer he wanted. Implicitly rejecting stalemate as a military objective, Westmoreland argued that the enemy was too deeply committed to be influenced by anything but the application of overpowering force. Even the full level of force that Westmoreland had requested would, not per se, cause the enemy to back off. Westmoreland told McNamara that, instinctively, we believe that there may be substantial additional U.S. force requirements. After the forces included in his request had stabilized the military situation, Westmoreland intended to use unspecified numbers of additional troops in 1966 to gain and maintain the military initiative. Even though McNamara had hoped to exact from Westmoreland an estimate of the number of troops needed to impose a stalemate, Westmoreland sought an open-ended commitment to the objective of overwhelming the enemy. McNamara's guidance to Goodpaster's group clearly revealed that civilian and military officials were going to war with dramatically different objectives in mind. McNamara and McNaughton, who continued to define the policy goal as maintaining U.S. credibility and prestige, envisioned achieving that goal by pursuing the military objective of stalemate in South Vietnam. In a July 2nd memo that he had cleared with McNamara, McNaughton suggested to Goodpaster that, to win in Vietnam, the United States would merely have to succeed in demonstrating to the VC that they cannot win. A stalemate, McNaughton suggested, would be tantamount to victory if it served as a way station along toward a favorable settlement. Goodpaster did not take McNaughton seriously and continued to develop plans based on the stated policy goal of maintaining a stable and independent non-communist government in South Vietnam. He established objectives that would require larger forces and fewer restrictions on military planning and operations than McNaughton and McNamara envisioned. Goodpaster urged the destruction of the war-supporting power of North Vietnam and the defeat of Viet Cong and North Vietnamese main force units in the South. Military action would not impose a stalemate as a way station to negotiations, but force the enemy to stop the war or render them incapable of continuing it. Goodpaster recalled that he had taken special care to make clear that the proposal was based on avoiding a stalemate. He did not, however, directly confront McNamara and McNaughton over what were apparent, if not explicit, disparities in the objectives pursued by military and civilian officials, which underlay recommendations of vastly different levels of force. Although McNamara implied that Goodpaster's study group should limit the scope of military actions it recommended, he failed to make explicit the limits and restrictions on the use of force that he had in mind. After a conversation with McNamara, McNaughton asked Goodpaster to minimize the amount of the team's creative effort that must go into analyzing the Rolling Thunder program or such proposals as the mining of the North Vietnamese harbors. Despite the insinuation that he should not study the effectiveness of the most controversial military measures taken or recommended so far, The guidance the good pastor received from McNamara permitted military planning based on the assumption that the United States would do everything it could. Good pastor's reply to the question of whether the United States could win in Vietnam was a qualified yes. To win, the study argued, the administration must lift restrictions and controls on the use of military force, with the exception of prohibitions on a land invasion of North Vietnam, the use of nuclear and chemical weapons, and mass bombings of population centers. Short of those few prohibitions, Good Pastor assumed, the military would have complete freedom of action, including ground operations in Laos to cut the Ho Chi Minh Trail, a full-scale air campaign against the North, and offensive operations in the South aimed at the destruction of enemy units. Once the president approved Good Pastor's strategy, military actions would not be subject to restriction, delay, or planning uncertainties. In essence, Good Pastor told McNamara that the United States would have to remove virtually all restrictions on the application of conventional military power to win in Vietnam. Because McNamara's military objectives were undefined, and because he had not communicated frankly with Good Pastor concerning limits on the use of force, Good Pastor's study offered military advice in a vacuum of political guidance. McNamara even attempted to persuade Good Pastor to drop from his study all assumptions concerning the limitations of the U.S. effort and replace them with an assumption that the large-scale introduction of U.S. troops would not provoke intensified enemy efforts. Good Pastor replied that, without making assumptions about what level of force the U.S. was willing to commit, he could not tell McNamara whether the U.S. could win. He also argued that the estimate should be based on the enemy's capabilities rather than on unrealistic assumptions concerning enemy intentions. The American military commitment in Vietnam grew without a reconciliation of Good Pastor's and McNamara's fundamentally different conceptions of how to prosecute the war. McNamara did not forward the Good Pastor study to the White House, but the plan did reach McGeorge Bundy's military assistant, Colonel Richard Bowman, on July 21st. Observing that the study had received no endorsement from McNamara, Bowman described it as a non-study and passed it to Bundy as background for the discussions on Vietnam. 30 years afterward, McNamara identified but did not seem to understand his failure to connect additional troop deployments to a strategy for ending the war on favorable terms. Citing the superficiality of his discussions with Westmoreland in Saigon, McNamara was puzzled by his inability to have thought deeply and realistically about Vietnam and his failure to have considered alternative courses of action and their consequences. He placed a large measure of the blame on Westmoreland for not having provided answers to questions such as what military strategy and tactics should be followed, how the Viet Cong would respond, how many casualties the United States would suffer, what responses could be expected to U.S. actions, and when they would occur. But in 1965, McNamara neglected strategic thought and focused entirely on tactical changes. The Defense Secretary informed Westmoreland that the main purpose of his July 1965 trip was to receive the MACV commander's recommendations for the numbers of troops required by the end of the year, the time schedule for deployment, and the probable requirements for additional forces next year. McNamara's challenge would be to exact from Westmoreland a request consistent with the number of troops that the president was willing to approve. Before McNamara's departure, McNaughton had already drafted the report that McNamara would send to the president on his return. McNaughton's deputy, Adam Yarmolinsky, recalled that McNamara's trip was theater, designed to justify decisions already made. On July 14th, as McNamara and his party departed for Saigon to discuss with Westmoreland the forthcoming troop deployments, the purpose of the use of force remained unclear. 2 days after he arrived in Saigon, McNamara received a literally eyes-only cable from his deputy, Cyrus Vance, confirming that the president intended to proceed with the deployment of 34 more battalions to South Vietnam because he feared that a troop deployment larger than that would kill the domestic legislative program. McNamara would, nevertheless, remain in Saigon for 3 more days of consultation. Indeed, having deepened American involvement in the war, according to a pattern determined by domestic political pressures, McNamara's charge was to return with a consensus behind a list of actions consistent with the president's desire to get the Great Society package through Congress. In the early 19th century, Clausewitz observed that the political object is the goal. War is the means of reaching it, and means can never be considered in isolation from their purpose. The Great Society, the dominant political determinant of Johnson's military strategy, had nothing to do with the war itself. As a result, the application of means continued to escalate without a vision of how military action might actually achieve the goals of the war. On July 20th, McNamara returned from Saigon and forwarded his prefabricated report to the president. Describing the objective of military force as demonstrating to the enemy that the odds are against their winning, he concluded with an ambivalent call to arms. McNamara predicted that his proposal, if properly integrated and executed with continued vigor and visible determination, stood a good chance of achieving an acceptable outcome within a reasonable time in Vietnam. His recommendation reiterated those actions the president had already decided to support. U.S. ground force deployments would increase to 34 battalions, or, if South Korea failed to provide 9 battalions promptly, 43. Limitations on the air campaign would continue, and McNamara dropped actions that he had included in earlier papers, such as the mining of Haiphong Harbor. McNamara's trip to Saigon raised the level of congressional interest in Vietnam. While Wheeler was away with McNamara, the other chiefs met with members of the House Armed Services Committee and Chairman L. Mendel Rivers's office. The representatives wanted the JCS to provide them with a comprehensive estimate of the amount of force that the war would ultimately require. If the chiefs answered the questions directly and honestly, they might be able to foil the president's plans for softening up the public and the Congress upon McNamara's return from Saigon. Coach Johnson would have been proud of his team. When the representatives asked if mobilization was necessary, the officers avoided answering. Although Harold Johnson had already notified major army commanders to prepare for a 1-year mobilization of reserve units and had outlined to them a specific program for increasing the strength of the army by 63 battalions, the army chief told the committee members that he didn't really know what his requirement was, now or in the future. After repeated questioning, Johnson replied that some 250,000 U.S. troops would be needed in Vietnam, about half the number he privately believed would be necessary to end the war on terms favorable to the United States and South Vietnam. McConnell refused to estimate the number of men the Air Force would require to satisfy the demands of the war. McDonald said that the Navy would require 40,000 more sailors, but did not state whether the increase would require mobilization of reserve forces. Although Green believed that the committee members must have deduced from the discussion the need for mobilization, the chiefs never made that requirement explicit. Near the end of the meeting, One of the legislators asked Green directly how many men would be needed to win the war in Vietnam. Amid the confusing and contradictory estimates of his colleagues, however, Green's estimate of 500,000 made no visible impression on the legislators. The questioning turned from troop requirements and mobilization to military action against North Vietnam. Rivers, a Democrat from South Carolina, took a nautical map of Haiphong Harbor out of a locked cabinet. Rivers and the committee's chief counsel, John R. Blanford, asked the JCS why they were not mining Haiphong Harbor and bombing fuel storage facilities in the port area. "Haven't you chiefs recommended that this be done?" Green deferred to McDonald and McConnell, who explained that the targets had been placed on a list, but that the attack times had not been specified. McDonald said that political factors, such as potential damage to neutral ships, had delayed them. Asked about other targets in the area, McDonald gave the same answer. Green thought that his colleague's statements were not truthful, in light of repeated JCS recommendations to attack those targets and mine the harbor. But he remained silent. Rivers asked Green why surface-to-air missile sites and air bases had been left untouched. Green said that he had been greatly concerned about the need to hit both targets and had advocated hitting the surface-to-air missile sites from the day the first shovel had been struck into the ground to construct them. Green's direct response contrasted with the reticence of his colleagues. The chiefs as a whole had been less than forthcoming. Representative F. Edward Hebert, a Democrat from Louisiana, told them that they were highly respected, but warned that their credibility would suffer unless they provided Congress with their honest opinions. Rivers told the chiefs that they were creatures of the Congress and therefore have a duty to them as well as to the executive branch. Harold Johnson responded defensively, arguing that he owed allegiance principally to the president. Johnson reminded the representatives that under the National Security Act, the chiefs were principal military advisors to the president, the National Security Council, and the Secretary of Defense. Green told the congressman that the chiefs found themselves in a very difficult position between the committee and the administration. Representative William H. Bates, a Republican from Massachusetts, described the National Security Act as the worst one that Congress ever passed. Green recorded at the time that the chief's evasive answers had left the committee in a fit of frustration. Green experienced conflicting feelings during the consultation with the committee members. Sympathetic to his commander-in-chief in the April White House meetings, when LBJ seemed besieged by opponents of the U.S. role in Vietnam, Green was nonetheless astounded by how few of the facts regarding the situation seemed to be known to the people's representatives. Green's loyalty to the president and reluctance to contradict his colleagues, however, prevented him from giving the legislators his full assessment of the situation. 2 hours after the meeting, he called John Blanford. Green told Blanford what he declined to say in the meeting. The United States, Green said, was on the verge of a major war that would ultimately involve a minimum of 500,000 troops. The war would take at least 5 years, and the United States would suffer a large number of casualties. To set conditions for winning the war, the United States would have to undertake an immediate intensification of operations against North Vietnam and within South Vietnam. Green had given Blanford privately the assessment that the chiefs had failed to provide either to Congress or to the administration. With the administration deceiving the people and Congress about the depth of the American military commitment in Vietnam, the JCS were in a quandary. Although the Constitution designated the president as commander-in-chief of the military, each member of the JCS was sworn to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. The Constitution charged Congress, as representatives of the people, with the responsibility to decide whether to declare war. The American people, through their representatives in Congress, were to determine whether South Vietnam's freedom and independence was worth the costs and risks. With the exception of Green, and then only in private to a staff member, the chiefs had decided to support their commander-in-chief by misrepresenting their own estimates of the situation in Vietnam. Green felt keenly the tension between loyalty to the president and his responsibilities to the American people, and had chosen a middle course of publicly supporting the administration while privately providing his actual views to the Congress. The chief's obligations to their soldiers, airmen, sailors, and Marines complicated already conflicting responsibilities. As American involvement in the war deepened, Lyndon Johnson remained determined to depict the war very differently from the way that Green had described it. Johnson would need congressional approval to mobilize reserves and to obtain additional funds to finance the war. Mobilization, or a request for funds, however, would have sparked an enormous controversy over Vietnam that might have led representatives to conclude that the country could not afford both guns and butter. Presidential aide Jack Valenti recalled that in July 1965, the president was in the middle of the biggest legislative fight of Johnson's history. Although he knew that financing the deployments that he had already decided to approve would cost approximately $8 billion in fiscal year 1966, the president thought it impossible for him to submit to Congress before January 1966 a supplementary budget request of more than $300 or $400 million. Intent on obscuring the cost of the war from the body that held constitutional authority over appropriations and declaring war, the president directed Vance to have the Defense Department ready to explain to Congress that no additional funds were needed until January, at which time they would be able to come up with clear and precise figures as to what is required. Separately, McNamara suggested that to avoid inflation, the president financed the war through additional taxation. Alluding to the difficulty of getting Congress to approve additional taxes for a war that had not gained enthusiastic public support, Johnson told McNamara to get your ass up to the hill and don't come back until you have the vote count. The president feared that a tax bill would sap the momentum behind his domestic legislation. He told McNamara, "God damn it, Bob, how many times do I have to remind you that after FDR tried to pack the Supreme Court and failed, he couldn't get Congress to pass the time of day?" After finding that the votes were not there, McNamara dropped his recommendation. LBJ recognized, however, that placing limits on the use of force in time of war because of domestic political concerns would incite controversy and opposition. Valenti observed that the last thing that Lyndon Johnson wanted was to make public his strategy about the Great Society and the war. He wasn't going to do it. There's no question that he wanted to sotto voce the whole thing. On July 19th, McGeorge Bundy showed the president a draft memo intended for key senators arguing that deeper U.S. involvement in Vietnam did not require additional appropriations. He included the observation that it would create the impression that we have to have guns, not butter, and would help the enemies of the president's domestic legislative program. Johnson ordered Bundy to rewrite the memo, eliminating the reference to the Great Society. It was clear to Bundy that the president would never admit that the Great Society shaped his Vietnam decisions because he would have thought that going around advertising that you're adjusting your public words to the nature of your legislative program suggested you didn't deserve to be in charge of the legislative program. While concern over an escalation of the war was genuine, Johnson exaggerated the danger of Chinese intervention to justify his unwillingness to ask congressional approval of measures that might jeopardize his domestic legislation. With McNamara's assistance, he contrived rationalizations that mobilization alone might provoke an escalation of the war, and that a sharp congressional debate over appropriations risked sending the wrong signal to Hanoi about American resolve. Between July 21st and 27th, Johnson held a series of meetings to defuse potential opposition to his Vietnam decisions. The JCS and the service secretaries met with the president on July 22nd. If the chiefs found limitations on the level of force under McNamara's option unsatisfactory, the other options the president presented, bugging out and maintain present force and losing slowly, were even more unpalatable to them. The president amplified his concern that if he gave Westmoreland all he asked for and expanded the air campaign in accord with JCS advice, China might come in. He told the chiefs that there are millions of Chinese. I think they're going to put their stack in. McNamara assisted the president by restricting discussion to the three alternative courses of action under consideration. As the meeting convened, he told the president that the JCS had only a short time to review his paper and were unprepared to discuss the requirements for a reserve call-up or budgetary matters, the matters about which the president was most concerned. Green did not abide by McNamara's ground rules. The Marine commandant began speaking softly. The president told Green, "I don't have a hearing aid." Green responded, "Well, Mr. President, I'll speak louder and make sure that you and everyone else in this room hears what I have to say." McNamara was visibly upset as Green expressed frustration over limitations on military force. He urged intensifying Rolling Thunder, blockading North Vietnam, and mining Haiphong Harbor. He told the president that winning the war in South Vietnam would take 5 years and 500,000 soldiers and Marines. Ignoring Green's estimate, the president continued to use the fear of escalation to parry JCS calls for more resolute military action. After Green recommended the deployment of 80,000 more Marines than Westmoreland had requested, the president asked, "Won't this cause them, China and the Soviet Union, to come in?" When Harold Johnson responded, "No, I don't think they will," the president reminded him that MacArthur didn't think they would come in either. After reviewing his handwritten notes of July 1965, McGeorge Bundy recalled that although the president emphasized a concern over an escalation of the war, his unspoken object was to protect his legislative program. All the chiefs, except Green, suppressed their misgivings about the president's plans to deepen slowly American involvement in the war and focused on the global political imperative of containing communism. MacDonald observed that the United States can't win an all-out war, but thought that a loss of international credibility that would attend a U.S. withdrawal left the United States with no choice but to send more troops. He offered weakly that the increase in the U.S. military effort would allow the United States to do better than we're doing. There was virtually no discussion of how the additional troops would be employed or how their actions might contribute to achieving policy goals. Although Green made one final plea for consideration of the enclave strategy, his challenge to Westmoreland's concept of seeking out and destroying the enemy sparked no debate. Wheeler made several references to the stated policy goal of maintaining South Vietnam as free and independent, but there was no attempt to reconcile that goal with McNamara's proposal that military force should aim to achieve a stalemate in the South. The shallowness of the discussion probably pleased LBJ. Harold Brown, who had attended the meeting as the nominee to replace Eugene Zuckert as Secretary of the Air Force, recalled that the president's principal concern was to get all of his advisors on the record in support of his decisions. At the president's request,